Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namasami. So this monastery is in the tradition of the Thai forest meditative tradition, which must be similar to the Sri Lankan Aranya tradition of the forest monasteries. And these are our teachers. So the center teachers, Thanajan Cha, who died in 91, I think, 1991? Or is it 92? I get it. Thank you. He died in 1992, and he was a very gifted teacher, and one of the gifts he had, even though he couldn't speak English, he attracted a lot of Westerners who had long hair. In the late 60s, early 70s, right until he stopped teaching. And then the teacher on the right is Thanajan Liam, and he is the abbot of Ajahn Chah's monastery, and he's much loved as well. He's about 80 now. And then the Western monk on the left pictures Ajahn Thanajan Sumedho, and he is Ajahn Chah's first Western disciple. So that's a kind of those are our parents, as it were. Pictures of parents. And the Thai forest tradition is one that emphasizes a strong sense of Vinaya for the monastic community. Work, there's a lot of physical work in the monastery, building, maintaining the place. And the idea of the work is not just as work in itself, but a way of developing community. And then also, obviously, the cultivation of meditation. So the life of a forest monk is one where we have both solitude, we have our own kutis where we meditate, and then the communal activity where we come together, learning from both. So meditation is a very big part of the training we do. And as monks, that's one of the strong words that we have. It's the idea of training. Training in body, speech, and mind. And as human beings, we can train. We're not just victims of karma, or victims of genes, or victims of habits, or victims of cultural preferences, or whatever. We can train, and that's one of the beautiful things of human intelligence, that we can use intelligence in a way which actually makes us better human beings, and hence we become more beautiful in the societies we live in. And one of the trainings that we're trying to do is a trainings in perception. In the Pali word is sanya. In the five khandhas you have sanya. And perception is it's what our worldview is built up of. So like perception obviously is something like, if I say to you, is the glass half empty or half full? Right? So I perceive it as half full, or I perceive it as half empty. So both have some accuracy, right? And yet, if I perceive it as half empty, that will condition my world in a certain way. I'll maybe be pessimistic. If I perceive it as half full, maybe I'll be optimistic. Maybe I'll be naive. Different. But you can see how perception might seem like it's true, but it's still kind of relative. Now, if my perceptions are accurate, then I'm going to live a better life. So I need functional perception. So now you all know where the parking lot is. If I say to you, parking lot, you know what that means. You have a word for it, you know where your car is, you know how to get to your car and go home. So those are what we call functional perceptions. I am a monk, you're a lay person, and so on. But there's other perceptions that we pick up culturally, that we pick up because of our gender, that we pick up because of our age, in all manner of ways. And some of those perceptions are not skillful, and some are skillful. And if we're not mindful of our perceptions, and we're not attentive to them, we're not intelligent about them, and we follow perceptions which are unskillful, we can get very unskillful results. So let's say I see all this media information about Muslim terrorism, right? I see that, and I begin to develop a bias in my mind that whenever I see someone wearing a scarf, a woman with a scarf over her head, I think she's a bad person, right? Now that's a perception that gets lodged in my mind because of the media, because of what people talk about, and it becomes racist, or it becomes a bias in the mind, and it becomes a form of hatred, right? Now, if I'm not aware that that is just a perception, that that's conditioned by culture and present events and so on, and I start to believe in that perception, then that's what my world becomes. So in a sense, I create my own world. And again, if the perception is very biased and hateful, then I'll get other people to agree to my perceptions. That's what we do, you know. Well, yeah, you're right, you're absolutely right. And then we'll gang together and we'll form a group, a very biased group. And that's, you see that so much in humanity, or the tragedy of human biases and prejudices. So one of the things the Buddha asked us to do was to develop perceptions of unity. And these are metta karuna or mudita. And the perceptions of unity are kind of like glass half full, glass half empty. So the perception of metta that the Buddha asked us to cultivate is the perception of goodwill. And goodwill in Buddhist practice is based upon a very simple consideration, is that I don't like pain, and just as I don't like pain, you don't like pain. I don't like to be insulted, just as I don't like to be insulted, you don't like to be insulted. I like comfort. I like emotional comfort, and so are you. You like emotional comfort. So we are one in this. I suffer when I see my parents in pain or my kids in pain, and you suffer when you see your parents in pain or your kids in pain. This is a unitive kind of perception, right? We can see differences. I'm a monk, you're a lay person. I'm a man, you're a woman. I am older, you are younger, I am this or that. We can see differences, and those perceptions are not wrong. They're not wrong. But if I believed in all the perceptions of difference, and they're based on aversion, based on jealousy, based on competitiveness, based on my own insecurity, based on racism, you know, all these perceptions that culture can have, and I was only picking up on those, then I would become, that would be a source of great suffering for myself and my society. It would be a force of alienation. But the other perception is that we are one in this. So like in a Buddhist funeral service in Thailand, the monks will often say, we are brothers and sisters in old age, sickness, and death. And that's true. We're all in it together. That's not the only perception, you know, but the Buddha said that this is a very important perception to develop, because that is the pathway, or that is one of the methods of peace. Because when we follow perceptions based on anger and greed and competitiveness and jealousy, those are perceptions which lead us to suffering and alienation. Where the perceptions of metta karuna, of compassion and goodwill, are perceptions which always put us in harmony. Now, other people might not have those perceptions. So I might have a perception, you know, that we are, like maybe I see someone and say, we are brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death. And said, what are you, some kind of Buddhist freak or something? So someone might insult me. Now I could take that insult, right, and call me a skinhead or been called all kinds of things. He said, what are you wearing, a brown dress? And so I could, that would be an insult maybe, you know, I'd feel insulted. Now I could take that insult and I say, well, you're just a silly guy that wears jeans, or you don't know what you're talking about. I could just go back at that, right? But that would be alienating and separating. Or I could take that sense of being insulted maybe, or being offended or being belittled in some way, and I can say, I could go to that feeling and say, oh, this is the feeling of being insulted. It's not a nice feeling. This is a feeling of being belittled. Not a nice feeling. And I just would feel that. I'd say, this is suffering. And then I could make a determination, I'm not going to do that to others. Now that's a very noble thing to do. And that's the Buddha's recommendation, is that if something hurts me, it's going to hurt other people in a similar way. Maybe not exactly, but similarly. And I make a determination, I'm not going to do that to other people. So I rise above the pettiness of that part of my cultural situation, my social situation. That takes a very noble kind of mind, and it takes mindfulness. Because the reactive mind, if someone insults me and belittles me in some way, and then my reactive mind might be wanting to punch back. I'm going to punch you back. You're not going to do this to me. And maybe that's necessary sometimes. I don't know. For me, generally, it's not. It hasn't been the case. But to have the kind of mindfulness of not noticing that reaction and making a choice from skill. The choice might be to be strong and say, that's inappropriate. That would be okay. Or to say, I'm not going to do that to others. That would be appropriate. But the choice, if it just comes from reactivity, if I have no mindfulness, if I have no sense of what's going on, then I'm just a victim of that person. That person's pettiness then is something that makes me petty. But if I'm mindful and I feel that, and I feel the urge maybe to strike back, and I wait and I pause, and then maybe I say something strong, or I reflect on compassion, it seems to me that then my world is being cultivated from wisdom rather than from reactivity, from just the blind reaction of habit. And so that's a training, isn't it? You know, it's a training in the way I view the world and the way I react to the world. And that training is enhanced through meditation. So where meditation plays a role in training the mind to be a better space to live in and to be a better person in society in general, is that when we sit down and meditate, it's a very difficult thing to do. Very difficult to train the mind, because the mind is so busy and so active and so reactive. And to actually stop and stop the mind from all, like, going into the internet or doing things or being active. There's nothing wrong with those things. But the mind, when it's not given some kind of space, it just becomes a very restless kind of reactive organism. It's just reactive all the time. It has no space. When we sit down and meditate, all of a sudden there's nowhere to go. I mean, you could have left the room if you wanted, but you know, we're all kind of honorable, so we sit it out. And so you feel restless maybe. Or you think, oh, why did I ever come here? I should have gone for a walk. Or you're falling asleep and you think, oh, I want to do something. Well, that very restlessness and consciousness that we have, or sleepiness, can be known. You can know that. I can know that. I can be aware of that. And if I'm aware of that, then my mind becomes less restless just by knowing it. Just as I can feel anger at someone, and I can know the anger, I can say the anger feels this way, and breathe and try not to react to it, or I can react to it, and then I become more angry. Same with the restlessness of the mind. So when we sit down to meditate, we're not so much looking for some kind of beautiful experience. Sometimes people think that you and you sit down, you meditate, and somehow you get blissed out. It doesn't work that way. What you get is the habit of mind, the habits of mind. And what I think we begin to see is that the mind can be very untrained, unreliable. Now, when nothing much is going on in your life, you know, when life is kind of you're getting along okay, and resources are good, and you're not sick, and people are sort of cooperating, that's all very well and good. You think, you know, your mind can just kind of wander or daydream or so on. But if the mind is not trained, then when difficulties come up and you find yourself emotionally overwrought or upset about something or worried about something or angry at someone or frightened about something, then those strong habits which come up when we feel threatened by life, when there is loss, when there's death, when there's unemployment, all those things, they're very powerful because now our life is threatened. And as they come up, if we have no inner resources, if we can't be mindful, they just rule. They just run, you know, they're the ones that run the planet. So I might feel all very, very well and good and da-da-da-da-da, and then all of a sudden I'm unemployed. I get laid off, and I've got to pay a mortgage, and I've got a lot of difficulties, and all of a sudden what that brings to mind is worry and fear, naturally, because one's afraid. Now, if I learn how to train the mind, when worry comes up and I've done some meditation, I know I can process that. I know I can process that through the body. I can develop breathing exercises to calm the mind down. But if I've never had any training, then the worry just, it takes over. And my mind just runs and runs and runs. And so people get depressed. They get very depressed. They're very worried or very anxious and have anxiety attacks and so on. That's the untrained mind. And it's not that life isn't going to bring its difficulties. It's just part of the curriculum is the ups and downs of success and failure in life and good fortune and bad fortune. But the training of the mind is always possible, whether good times or bad times. Now, one of the interesting things that we don't tend to notice, it's a kind of subtle thing, and I try to allude to this in this meditation, is that I asked you, listen to sound, and then I said, feel the body. Right? I asked you to do that exercise. Listen to sound, feel the body. If you're thinking, then you don't notice what I'm talking about. But hopefully, you let go of thinking and you listen to sound. So first of all, you have to let go of thought. You have to come into the present moment. Listen to thought. And then I said that sound is in awareness, and the body is in awareness. Now, usually the perception we have, right? The perception we have is I'm sitting here and you're out there, which is true. You're not sitting here, I'm sitting here looking there. But all of that is taking place in awareness. So there's a sense of me and there's a sense of you and there's distance and so on. And that is taking place in awareness. In awareness. Now, why is that important? Because it's only in awareness will you find peace. Like my perspective of you, like if I got blinded and I can't see, that changes, so I can't see you anymore. But I can know that I'm blind because awareness, blindness is in awareness. I can know that I'm blind. I can have an accident. I can lose my arm. Horrible thought. I like my arm. It's very handy. Oh, that was terrible. It's nice to have an arm, right? So it gets chopped off. We work with machines, so sometimes you get a bit afraid. Arm gets chopped off. Now, the horror of that, I've put this thumb through this thumb is shorter than the other one, notice? I put it through one of these saws. Not, they don't let me on the saws much anymore. So it's just hanging there. It's an awful, awful, awful experience, right? But that takes place in awareness. And even the most horrible kind of thing, you can be aware of. So we say awareness is a refuge because it can know the changing nature of our predicament of being human beings. And awareness, you cannot diminish awareness. You can't lose the thumb of awareness. because awareness has no appendages. You can't really criticize awareness. You can't judge awareness. Awareness, you were wrong, because awareness isn't judging. Awareness knows judgment. Awareness knows sound. Awareness knows pain. Awareness knows the feeling of loss. It just knows. And so one of the ways when we talk about taking refuge in Buddha, Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, we say that which knows is our refuge. So that which knows I feel happy is not happiness. That which knows I feel sad is not sadness. Happiness and sadness come and go, but they come and go in awareness. And now most people don't get that perception. We don't function like that. So when we feel happy, oh great, it's great, you know, everything's good, and you know, it's all gonna be good forever. And then the happiness changes into something, and then we blame. Oh, it's your fault, or I did something wrong, we're disappointed. And so our minds get attached. This is what we call attachment or grasping. We get attached to these changing emotional conditions and physical conditions and societal conditions and views and opinions and all the rest of it. And so we seek our happiness in that which changes. So we're kind of always looking outside. But there is a kind of peace of the mind which we don't usually notice, because it's so very close. It's so close to us. It's our real home. And that is that awareness of change is actually peaceful. Like I can feel upset by something. That upsetness is not nice. Right? I feel upset by, I've got some bad news maybe. Like maybe I get some, eventually I'll get some diagnosis. I'm getting on now. So eventually I'm going to get some diagnosis. Well, Viradhamma, your time's up. It's got to happen, right? Sooner or later. I'm 66, probably sooner than later. And so what happens then? I get the diagnosis that your head's going to fall off, or you've got cancer or something like that. Now that would be a shock, maybe. Even though I think, oh, I'll be okay. I'm cool. I'm a monk and all the rest. Not necessarily. So I get the diagnosis and the doctor says, well, your liver's falling out, or something like that. Now that's a shock to the system. So I feel shocked, maybe. But awareness knows the shock. Awareness is bigger. It's bigger than the shock. Oh, this is what shock feels like, or this is what fear feels like. And if we can take that as our refuge, that this is taking place in awareness, we take that as our refuge, the fear certainly is there, but it comes and it goes. But if we don't have a refuge, if we don't have a refuge in something then bigger than our emotions, bigger than our body, bigger than our families, bigger than our society, something larger that contains it all, we're victims. You know, we think everything's going well, and then all of a sudden we lose something. Oh, I've lost it. But the awareness can know that. Awareness can be aware of that. That's why it's a refuge. And so in meditation, we're training actually in Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. We're training in taking refuge. Not as a cultural piece, you know, where I believe in the Buddha, the historical Buddha, and so on. That's good. That I do that. I love the Buddha. I love his teachings. I love homage. I love vandana. I love all the devotional parts of the sasana. I love that. But what is the real refuge? You know, Buddha as some kind of historical person, how does that help when I'm feeling fear? No, I think the real refuge is actually this awake mind, this aware mind. And that aware mind can watch things come and they go. And again, it's a perception, it's a way you look at things. Just like, you know, I can perceive the half glass, that glass half full, the glass half empty. I can perceive, let's say, disappointment. Let's say someone, I'm relying on them to do so. I'm relying on, let's say I lend some money to someone. I don't have any money, so I can talk about this. I lend some money to someone. I lend them $1,000. And they say, oh yeah, I'll pay you back next week. And they don't pay me back week after week after week after week. Now that's going to create disappointment in my mind. Now functionally, I have to do something. I have to say, okay, pay up, or cut my friendship, or whatever I have to do. I have to get an explanation. But the very feeling of disappointment, the feeling of disappointment, is something that comes into consciousness, right? It comes into consciousness, and it stays for a while, Now, how long does it stay? This is interesting. How long does that disappointment stay? Well, if I grasp or attach to disappointment, then it perpetuates maybe for days. I feel angry at the person, and you know, they were a friend, and I trusted them, and I needed that money, and I've got to pay some car payments, and then I see the person, and then what my perception is, you bandit, and my mind interprets from that, and my whole world gets obsessed, and this is what obsession is about, because I take refuge in the disappointment. Actually, I take refuge in the disappointment. So functionally, I have to do something. I have to say no. You know, we had an agreement to whether, but emotionally, and how I live my life, if I have no refuge, then disappointment, then just I run with it for days, maybe. I get obsessed with it. And then that changes to something else, some other kind of obsession. There's no freedom in that. There's no freedom at all. Because we don't have control. You know, we try to do the best we can to organize our friendships and so on, but lo and behold, people, you know, they might rip us off, or they might hurt us, or they might insult us, or they might be very loyal and helpful and friendly. You know, we have limited choices. But awareness can handle all of that. The feeling of disappointment and the feeling of gratification, these are two feelings. They're part of being a human being. But the awareness is something that is bigger than that. So we say it's transcendent. It is truly a refuge. So ponder, like when life changes in ways which are beautiful or ugly, inspiring or uninspiring, boring or exciting, what does your mind do? Does your mind have some sense of stability, or does it just react all the time? And if it's reactive all the time, then be careful. Be careful, because that reactivity, then when things get serious, you become the kind of victim of that. So in training in perception, this perception that this is in awareness, it's a very strange one. I'm sitting here, you're sitting there, I feel something, you feel something, right? Now, let's say if Russ back there, he starts waving his hands up and down or making a rumpus, right? And then I feel irritated. Now, certainly there's me, and there's Russ, right? And I might have to say something. But all of that, that whole scenario of my feeling and his behavior, is something that arises in consciousness. It's one piece. It's just one piece. And that is in awareness. And I can perceive that way. I can say, oh, this is in awareness. And when I do that, I have space in my mind. I'm no longer just locked into a reaction. I have space. I can make choices. I can choose. Oh, Russ is having a moment. Or I can say, stop it, Russ. Or, you know, I have choices. But they're coming from a spacious awareness of the way things are, rather than an attachment and reaction to what's going on. It seems to me that's very important. Otherwise, we're always victims to these different kinds of social inner situations that we have. And it's just it's a kind of very subtle kind of perspective. It's not kind of weird religion or something. It's just a very subtle kind of perception. We don't usually perceive in this way. We usually perceive me and you. You're like this and I'm like this. You shouldn't be like that. Oh, you're great or you're not great. Oh, you're whatever. That kind of self and other. This is a non-ego perception. The other is an ego perception. A non-ego perception is, this is taking place in awareness. So my sense of me, like let's say if you insult me and I feel, oh, you're absolutely right, my sense of lack of self-worth arises with your words, right? And then you say something maybe complimentary and I feel confident. My sense of confidence arises with your words. It's all one piece. It's all one, like one theater. And then that changes to another theater. So there's just different theaters playing out, and they're not reliable. They're really not reliable. What is reliable is developing the mind. What is reliable is developing good perceptions. So the perceptions of compassion, the perceptions of unity, and this kind of curious perception, this is happening in awareness. It's a very subtle one, but it's where peace lies. It's where peace lies, in the heart and in the mind. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection today.
Andamaya mawada tama kataya sadhu karanga dama se sadhu 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 anumodami. Let's